This is a podcast from BFM 89.9, the business station.
7:48 a.m. You're listening to The Morning Run with Shazana Shawning and Philip. Prime Minister Datuk Seri Anwar Ibrahim concluded a three-day official visit to Saudi Arabia last week, coinciding with the start of Ramadan. The PM led a delegation of senior officials, including Foreign Minister Datuk Zamri Qadir and Communications and Digital Minister Fahmi Fazil.
During the visit, Anwar Ibrahim met with the heads of the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, OIC, and the World Muslim League in Mecca, in addition to witnessing the signing of several MOUs involving Malaysian and Saudi businesses. However, a noticeable omission from his schedule were bilateral meetings with Saudi government officials such as his Saudi counterpart, Prime Minister and Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman or King Salman Abdul Aziz.
Malaysian government officials explained that the Saudi government had requested for Anwar to extend his visit by 2 days due to the changes in the Saudi leader's schedule, but the PM was unable to fulfil this request due to other commitments. What then were the key takeaways of this visit and what does it bode for future Malaysia-Saudi bilateral ties?
So joining us to discuss this is Dr. James Dorsey, Adjunct Senior Fellow of the S. Rajaratnam School of International Studies. Good morning, James. Thanks, as always, for joining us. Let's take a big picture lens on Malaysia-Saudi bilateral relations. Prior to Anwar Ibrahim, how would you characterize Saudi Arabia's relations with Malaysia across the many prime ministers that we've had?
Good morning. I think we've seen a bit of a seesaw in recent years in relations between Saudi Arabia and Malaysia. So you clearly had very close relations at the time of Najib. In fact, the Saudis were willing to give Najib a certain degree of protection with regard to the 1MDB scandal when they essentially said that they had, or that a gift from Saudi Arabia had been given to Najib. You then got the government of Mahathir, which took a much more critical attitude. One, you had a defense minister who has a history of being critical of Saudi Arabia. You had the closure of the King Abdullah Counterterrorism Center that had been funded by the Anti-Terrorism Counterterrorism Center that had been funded by the kingdom. And you had Mahathir, of course, taking on the issue of 1MDB and holding both the UAE and the United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia accountable. Since then, the issue of the of 1MDB as it relates to Gulf states, including Saudi Arabia, has been more or less settled. The fact that Anwar has not met either the king or the crown prince is a mystery. There is, as far as I can see, no good political reason why the Saudis would want to snub Anwar. This looks much more like some sort of bureaucratic mistake rather than a designed intent to snub or humiliate Anwar.
Perhaps an aberration then. The question then is, what does Anwar Ibrahim specifically bring to the table, right, in enhancing ties with Saudi Arabia? You know, Anwar has, I think, built a good relationship with certain countries like Turkey. I wonder how his experience and philosophy of approaching diplomacy will help or work with Saudi Arabia.
Well, I think it's a mixed bag. Anwar has had traditionally very good relations with the Saudis. Now, that was particularly in a period in which Anwar was close to the Muslim Brotherhood, and the Saudis were in many ways backing the Muslim Brotherhood, or at least allowing it in many ways to operate also within the kingdom. That obviously has changed under Mohammed bin Salman. Now, having said that, Anwar is also representing an interpretation of Islam that is far less conservative than what Saudi Arabia represented prior to the rise of the Salmans, and in many ways somewhat more in line with what Mohammed bin Salman is propagating. So again, I don't see that there is an intrinsic reason why the Saudis would want to put their relationship with Malaysia at stake by not having met by Mohammed bin Salman, not meeting the prime minister while he was in Saudi Arabia. There may also have been some aberration on the Saudi side.
Okay, meanwhile, while Anwar Ibrahim was in Saudi Arabia, he did indicate that Malaysia is open to cooperating with the Taliban, provided that women and girls are not denied education in Afghanistan. I mean, is this a pretext to avoid engaging with them in the first place?
Well, I don't think that that Anwar's position is any fundamentally different from that of other countries. Internationally, everyone has essentially refused to recognize the Taliban government as long as it doesn't produce a more inclusive government, which includes adhering to fundamental rights, including for education, of women in Afghanistan. That hasn't stopped, for example, Qatar and Turkey on the one hand, and the United Arab Emirates on the other hand, competing for example, the security contract at Kabul International Airport. That's a contract that the Emiratis have won. So you are seeing states doing a degree of business, China the same thing, with the Taliban without officially recognizing the government. So I don't know that the policy that Anwar has put forward is fundamentally any different from that of a number of other states.
If we can come back to Saudi Arabia and looking at the Asia-Pacific region more broadly, how much emphasis does Saudi Arabia place on relations here, especially in Southeast Asia? I mean, what do you see as the driving factors in Saudi's foreign policy stance in the region?
Well, first of all, I think that Saudi Arabia, by definition, as is true for other Gulf states, need to look very closely, for example, at the Indo-Pacific strategy. Let's be clear, there is no Indo-Pacific strategy that does not include the Arabian Sea. That's the western end of the Indo-Pacific. Asia is, moreover, Saudi Arabia's largest trading partner, with China up front, but also Japan, Korea, and others. In Southeast Asia, I think there are very important relations between the Saudis and Singapore. Indonesia's a major country, not only because of the fact that it is the largest and most populous Muslim majority state, but also because it's an ideological challenge in religious terms, and a fundamental challenge on the liberal side, to a certain degree, if you wish, to what Mohammed bin Salman interprets as a moderate but autocratic form of Islam. So Southeast Asia is important and will remain important to the Saudis.
And James, can you give your perspective globally, right? With Saudi's diplomacy, how has economics or the economy now shaped its view of diplomacy? Because we've seen so much work and effort done by Saudi Arabia to kind of reinvent its economy, right, and move away towards more tourism, market-based economic principles. I wonder, in your view, right, how does that diplomacy then get affected or translated then?
Well, I think there are a couple of factors at play here. One is a global factor, and that is that we're transiting maybe two steps forward, one step backwards, but nonetheless we're transiting towards away from a unipolar world order in which the United States is the superpower. Most people talk about a bipolar world, China and the United States. I think we're going to, within a decade, look at a tripolar world order, which would include India. What that means for middle powers, like, for example, Saudi Arabia, is that we're going to see that same new world order populated by middle powers who have greater agency, greater leverage, may not, like was the case in the Cold War, want to choose sides and will play all sides against the middle in order to protect their own interests. What we're also seeing with Saudi Arabia, but also with other Middle Eastern states, that they're willing to put whatever disputes and conflicts they have to essentially freeze them, no disputes, whether that's with Turkey and the Gulf states, whether that's between Turkey and Egypt, Turkey and Israel, or for that matter now Saudi Arabia and Iran. None of these states have solved any of the differences between them. What they're trying to do is manage conflict rather than resolve conflict, to buy themselves time so that they can focus on economic issues. And that is, for Mohammed bin Salman, particularly important. He has a, like other Gulf states do, a vision and a plan to diversify and restructure and streamline the economy, which he hopes to do by 2030. And in many ways, the survival of the regime in Saudi Arabia will depend on the success of those diversification and economic restructuring plans.
James, thanks very much for speaking with us. That was Dr. James Dorsey, Adjunct Senior Fellow of the S. Rajaratnam School of International Studies, giving us his takeaways from the visit of the Prime Ministers to Saudi Arabia, as well as Saudi Arabia's future direction and how foreign policy plays into this. It's 7:59 in the morning. We're heading into the 8 a.m. news bulletin. And then after that, we do have the breakfast grill, where I'll be speaking to Datin Mina Chiafong, Managing Director of In Nature Berhad, the brand owner of The Body Shop in Malaysia, Cambodia and Vietnam. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9.
You have been listening to a podcast from BFM 89.9, the business station. For more stories of the same kind, download the BFM app.